Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Beverly Clough. Her book today is The Spaces of Mental Capacity Law, Moving Beyond Binaries, and it was published by Routledge in 2022. I'll let her tell you more about herself. So, Dr. Beverly Clough, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Just to get us started, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to write The Spaces of Mental Capacity Law, Moving Beyond Binaries?
Yeah, so my background really is in medical law and bioethics, and I guess I've got a particular interest in feminist approaches, particularly in the context of mental capacity law. And I think, you know, as I kind of did a little bit more reading and kind of writing around mental capacity law, there were kind of two things that really stuck out to me in this area. One was this really curious absence of disability and disability studies in mental capacity scholarship. And it seemed really striking given the particular groups of people who are kind of the primary focus of mental capacity law. So that seems strange to me. And also, secondly, I think there was in kind of bioethics and feminist bioethics, but also in this mental capacity context, there's a lot of critique of autonomy and this kind of huge body of scholarship on relational autonomy, you know, and calls for rethinking and recognizing care, interdependence as part of that. But I often found that other concepts that were linked to autonomy were less kind of rigorously challenged, and they were sort of seemed to me to be a little bit more taken for granted. So paternalism, for example, often is kind of uncritically deployed in these discussions. So it seems there's a lot around autonomy, but less so around the other concepts that it's linked to. And I think really in this area, the UNCRPD has been a really kind of injected this invitation really to begin to rethink things a little bit more broadly than just simply autonomy. And really to think about disability as a big part of capacity and agency and legal capacity. So it's really provided this kind of critical impetus. So for me, it's been this time where I've come from this kind of feminist bioethical background and you know, my work on mental capacity law, but the CRPD's injected this need to rethink it through things like disability, positive obligations. And yeah, so I was very fortunate to get an ISRF early career fellowship, which gave me this year of just really immersing myself in disability studies, literature, in literature in human geography and legal geography, and, you know, the kind of new materialist science and technology studies literature, and just to really try and open up some of these debates in mental capacity law, inspired, I guess, by the CRPD, but not necessarily totally wedded to the CRPD.
I found that so striking in your book. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I do some research on the CRPD, and it's this idea of human geography and legal geography wasn't something that I was really familiar with. Maybe you can tell me and the listeners a little bit more about this and how it sort of relates to your book.
Yeah, so for me, I think when I started to think about the CRPD and to think about the Mental Capacity Act, it was almost this really striking, almost physical move of people into these separate realms of a capacitous subject or an incapacitous subject. And when, you know, that this real striking binary there, it's one of the more obvious ones that I talk about. But it's as I say, it's this kind of physical moving of somebody into this realm of incapacity. And what then happens? What are the kind of logics that frame how law responds to them, how the state responds in that situation? And it seemed to me a real instance of boundary drawing and kind of shaping these boundaries of responsibility and accountability. So the, you know, just looking through a lot of the legal geography literature and also a lot of the human geography literature, particularly in disability studies, you get this really strong sense of these processes of boundary drawing. What they, you know, how that helps to draw lines around responsibility, how that helps to also shape the subject as well and kind of legal subjectivity. And I think that this provided a really interesting and useful for me framing to start to think about these issues through. Because I think when I started to look at these binaries and how they are so connected and so reliant upon each other, it was really helpful to see how you can then begin to challenge some of them and to trace how they've been created and why they are so pervasive and why they are so kind of, they're seen as common sense. They're seen as, you know, this is just the way that it is laid out. And this, you know, this is the way that the law should be. And I think, you know, legal geography teaches us to think about it as more of a process. And they have been created in these ways, you know, it's not just the kind of discovery of spaces, it's this creation of spaces and why and who and who's kind of had the role in creating those spaces and the power issues that are kind of at the center of that.
There's so much I want to unpick about that, but just sort of coming back to the main theme of the book, and, you know, moving this idea of moving beyond binaries. I really enjoyed your framing of the law's response to mental capacity as positioned in this sort of series of binaries. Can you tell me more about where this came from and sort of how it worked throughout the book as well?
Yeah. So I think one that I've mentioned a little bit already is this autonomy paternalism binary. And that was really the starting point for me. And that, you know, a lot of my earlier work and, you know, when I was doing my master's and my PhD and looking at relational autonomy and feminist bioethics, this seemed to be the big framing binary around, you know, how do we respond to individuals in a medical context? Is, you know, if we start to encroach on their decision making, then that's verging on paternalistic, and paternalism is this kind of bad thing to be avoided. It's set up in this kind of direct opposition to respecting people's autonomy. So, I mean, that's really traced through as well into the Mental Capacity Act. And I think, you know, there's no I talk in a book about how a lot of the mental capacity, the work around the development of the Mental Capacity Act really seemed to occur at the same time as this kind of heyday of autonomy in bioethics and that kind of the big rise in autonomy as a leading principle in bioethics. You know, you can really trace that through the Law Commission's work and how autonomy and paternalism are positioned in that. But I think what's really striking when you start to dig down in the Mental Capacity Act is how other binary frameworks are really carefully interwoven with that autonomy paternalism binary, and they're kind of mutually dependent on each other and they mutually sustain each other. So things like empowerment versus protection, and you often see this in, I mean, most discussions of mental capacity law that I see, it's, you know, it's, are we empowering or are we protecting? And it's often just kind of trotted out as a sort of mantra. And I think I'm intrigued really as to what else is allowed or not allowed to be included as part of that consideration. We've got the public-private divide, which I talk about in the book as well, and it's a kind of long-standing feminist legal preoccupation with this public-private divide and what it does. You know, tying into ideas about the state and the individual, but also I think disability and non-disability, which, as I've already said, I think it's slightly remarkable that disability it's not really being engaged with much in the kind of the earlier mental capacity work. I think David Carson's work in the kind of early 90s is a counterpoint to that, but otherwise there's not been a very strong critical approach to disability and that kind of disability non-disability binary that we see. But I think what's interesting is how, as I said, these binaries all seem to shape these kind of logics of mental capacity law, and they are so dependent on each other. And I think this, you know, one of the things that I'm wanting to do with the book, kind of, as I said, inspired in some ways by the CRPD and the way it invites us to start to tear apart some of these binaries and to unpick them and to look at things from a different perspective, is really to encourage scholars to recognize that we might be able to chip away at one side of one of these binaries. So, for example, we can focus a lot of our attention on critiquing autonomy, but we also have to be very mindful about what that is also entangled with. You know, if we do start to chip away at one of these binaries, or at least half of one of these binaries, other binaries might be shored up, and that can have unforeseen consequences. It could have deeply problematic consequences. You know, so it's just this awareness of how they link together, how those links have been created and how those boundaries have been drawn over time.
That's so interesting. So perhaps maybe you could tell me, coming back to one of your earlier points, tell me more about this process of boundary drawing. Especially with regards to like legal geography.
Yeah, so I think that in the book there's quite a few of these kind of binaries that I talk about, as I've just mentioned. And I think one of the things that I start to think about in the book is how, you know, who is part of these processes of boundary drawing, and what do these boundaries do? So it's not just through judicial reiteration, but I think this is one of the things that I focus on through looking at the judgments of the Court of Protection. But to look at the ways that judges will see themselves as not creating law, not shaping law, and they kind of see themselves as discovering these kind of pre-existing boundaries that we have. And I think in Chapter 7, when I talk about the public-private divide, I look at this in quite a bit of detail as to how, you know, in law we don't necessarily see ourselves as part of the drawing of boundaries, but actually these judicial reiterations of things like the public-private divide, or of things like autonomy versus paternalism. These are part of these processes of entrenching, re-entrenching, maintaining these boundaries and these binaries, and just really shoring up these logics that they're all entangled with.
And so this relates to another point you just made. You talked about who is part of the process and what do these processes do. But then earlier you also talked about the way that these processes, it is shored up in judgments and law, the way that these shape legal subjectivity. Can you talk a little bit more about this concept of legal subjectivity and, you know, through the processes and what sort of happens and what does legal subjectivity look like, especially in the context of your book?
Yeah, so I think as a starting point for my work with the book, and it alongside many kind of feminist legal scholars, I was concerned with the way that we have this kind of liberal legal subjectivity, which is tied to this kind of abstract, individualistic, unencumbered, masculine subject. There's nothing necessarily new or remarkable there, but I think it's interesting to think about how that features in the mental capacity framework. And you can see it very strongly in the way that capacity is assessed. And I think people like to think of the Mental Capacity Act as this kind of politically neutral legal framework that's, it's just about this objective test of someone's mental capacity and their best interest. But you can see just through this, the way that mental capacity and the assessment of capacity is framed, that there's a particular legal subject that is envisaged by the legal framework. So it is about this kind of rational, autonomous individual. The focus is on the individual's best interests. And this is really kind of tied into this, the work that I think disability studies scholars have done about how disability is created and crafted as the other. And it kind of reinforces this normative idea of what the kind of liberal subject is and should be. Disability is seen as the other to that, and I think you can really see this strongly with the Mental Capacity Act and how the incapacitated individual is kind of shifted into this realm of the other, whereas the capacitated individual embodies exactly, this ideal liberal legal subject, the kind of thinking, rational, autonomous person. And this is really kind of reinforced throughout different parts of the Mental Capacity Act. So again, we see in terms of the kind of state individual binary that we see, and that really kind of creates this idea again of the state shouldn't intervene in this autonomous individual's life. There's only certain circumstances in which it's okay for them to do so. And the state is kind of positioned as this separate entity that hasn't had a role in that individual's life. They're kind of there. I kind of envisage it as a state as kind of hovering over but not actually involved, unless we can move this individual into this realm of the other, and then the state can intervene. I think just even though we're not necessarily thinking about legal subjectivity, I think we get a strong sense of the ideal liberal legal subject coming through. And I think disability studies and particularly the kind of human geography literature that engages with disability studies is really useful for legal scholars in this area, actually, to think about how law is part of these kind of processes of disability. And it's not this kind of neutral process, again, that's just kind of discovering these spaces and creating categories, but it's having a role in reinforcing ideals of, the ideal subject, the disabled subject, and, you have responsibility as kind of part of that.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And your book really does challenge this idea of, you know, these sort of binaries and law itself as being inherently neutral, because I think what comes through in all of these concepts, you know, and, you know, it can be argued even reading the CRPD that these sort of concepts like autonomy are actually neutral, and, you know, the legal subject is objectively neutral. But sort of, you know, one of the key takeaways from your book and then one of the key challenges that it presents is that actually these sort of common sense binaries are not, in fact, necessarily so common sense or should be accepted at all. They shouldn't just be sort of assumed to be neutral. I mean, if I have no other takeaway from your book, I mean, I do have many, but one of the key takeaways you just said is that this idea of the state shouldn't, you know, isn't permitted to intervene unless a person is sort of categorized as the other. And that it's, you know, so interesting the way that the law does this. So I guess then perhaps this is a good time to ask you, you know, your second chapter is titled The Conceptual Terrain, Spatial Dynamics and the Law. I'm interested to know, you know, and also with your background, talking about your background of bioethics and feminist studies. So then how does space construct networks of power?
Yeah, a big question. I guess there's a few ways that I could think about this. But a big part of it, I guess, for me is in terms of how space is used to draw these boundaries around responsibility and accountability. I think, you know, this is one of the things that's been most striking in kind of thinking through the book and reading the cases through this particular lens that I've been kind of thinking through. Because the way that these boundaries are drawn around the individual and the state has a... It's not just about creating the kind of legal subject and reinforcing the ideal legal subject, but it's also about limiting state responsibility often and obscuring the role that the state and institutions have already had in people's lives and in creating those situations of inequality or oppression or disadvantage. It's often about invisibilizing the state. And I think this is kind of big part of the way that power is kind of shifted through these networks and these kind of spatial designations. And I think it's really interesting to think about things like the social model of disability through this lens. And I really do hope that there's kind of more attention in kind of disability studies to the role of law. I don't think it's necessarily always been, I think generally, and I think I do talk about this actually in the book right at the beginning, I think generally there is a, law is seen as this very kind of black letter doctrinal creature to those in other disciplines. And I think, you know, one of the things that I really hope that comes from the book is if it is read by people in different disciplines, that there might be more engagement with the way that law has got a really important role to play in things like, you know, in the social model of disability. But just in terms of thinking about these kind of what space is doing and what these spatial processes are doing, thinking about it through the social model of disability, I really see it's about kind of closing off the idea that the state has or should have any role actually responding to impairment, or that it hasn't, it's kind of denying its role in the creation of disability. And I talk a little bit in the book about the kind of Cheshire West case, certainly when it was in the Court of Appeal, and Lord Justice Mumby's discussion of the relevant comparator when it comes to deciding on whether or not someone's been deprived of their liberty. And this idea of in defining a deprivation of liberty, who are we kind of comparing that in relation to? And this really striking idea that he had, that it's about comparing their situation to other people like that. And that was the way that it was phrased in that case. Hugely problematic. But for me, that really tied into this individualized model of disability as being this kind of internal limiting factor on someone's life that the state just had no role in. And you really see that coming through in other chapters that in the book, when I do look a little bit more at liberty and the kind of the philosophical approaches to disability and liberty, and again, this real, the way that disability is envisaged through this is really problematic. But to me, it's a total denial of the state's role as part of disability. And it's about the way that these boundaries are drawn around who the individual is, who the state is, when and where interventions can happen, and totally ignoring the historical role of the state and institutions in creating that the situation at that point in time that the law is focused on.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So then, picking up on this point about the CRPD and especially the social model of disabilities, through your analytical lens, do you feel that the CRPD does break down or at least attempt to break down these sorts of binaries, or does it almost reinforce this concept of black letter doctrinal law?
I think that's a really good question. Certainly, my approach has been that it provides this kind of critical impetus to think about it differently. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like it's turning these logics of mental capacity law on their head. So I think a lot of the scholarly work, particularly in the mental capacity context, has been on Article 12 of the CRPD, and this right to legal capacity on an equal basis with others. And the reason that I think there's been so much attention to that is because it just totally goes against the grain of the legal framework that we've all been working in and thinking through. And it is a real challenge to try to get our heads out of that and to think how it might look differently if we were to try and, think about a legal framework that is compliant or totally compliant with that. And you see these concerns about if we were to give, to say that people had legal capacity on an equal basis with others and that everyone has this kind of equal right to support to exercise that legal capacity, what might that look like? Would it be, would it be driven by a framework that denies people legal capacity, or would it be driven by a framework that says the state won't intervene in anyone's decision making? Mm-hmm. My concern has been that some of those interpretations have been so driven by the framework that we've already got that, we've kind of been driven down these dead ends in thinking, and we're hitting up against the same binaries that are part of the mental capacity legal framework. And I don't think that there's been necessarily a full kind of open assessment of we take the Mental Capacity Act out of it. We shouldn't be driven by that pre-existing framework, because that's explicitly built on the idea that people with cognitive impairments can be seen as lacking mental capacity, which is then used as a denial of legal capacity. And I think really that was what drove me to write the book, is I was, you know, it was like the Mental Capacity Act is this common sense framework, and that is the kind of static legal landscape that we have to work with, and let's try and inject the Article 12 or inject the CRPD into that. Whereas I think for me, it's about allowing ourselves to have that logic turned on its head and to see, you know, to see where that takes us. But I do get that the, you know, some of the criticism of the committee on the CRPD and some of the criticism that they haven't necessarily, you know, they've given some very strong assertions about what Article 12 might look like, but not necessarily address the concerns that some people have had about what would that mean in terms of potentially leaving people in abusive situations or removing protection for them. I guess for me, my approach has been to see the CRPD more as a whole and not just to hinge everything on capacity. Because I think, again, that is us being driven by the mental capacity framework and not necessarily taking a step back and thinking perhaps about all the other articles of the convention and how they play a really important role in themselves supporting legal capacity and supporting legal agency, such to the point that we might not need that question about capacity and incapacity there. But I think it opens up so many really interesting questions. I know when I talk to the kind of undergraduates on the, you know, on the medical law modules about Article 12 and what it might mean, is, you know, is it about disability neutrality? Can we have disability neutrality in these kind of legal frameworks? But for me, I think that idea of on an equal basis with others is really crucial, because it really takes away that focus that we've got at the moment, which is about separating individuals and saying you're a capacitous individual, you're an incapacitous individual based on disability or non-disability. It really gets us to move away from that. And there are lots of different directions, I think, that could take us in legally. But again, we need to be really mindful of these other binaries that those are tied up with, but also about the, as I say, the other articles of the UNCRPD and what they also are signalling about the role of the state and an intervention.
Yeah, there's so much there. It's sort of, on the one hand, I think you're saying, you know, we can't be limited by the binaries that we've come to be used to and not almost become blind to seeing, like, for example, in the Mental Capacity Act. At the same time, you know, the scholarship from the UNCRPD does focus on this idea of equality before the law present in Article 12. And it's almost as if, you know, this, as you just said, you know, Article 12 is being fed into these existing systems, and what we actually need to do is move beyond that and perhaps question further these binaries, and sort of, it's almost a bit unsettling for lawyers, I think.
Yeah.
I also found really interesting, so you talked about this and gave sort of, I wouldn't say suggestions, but sort of contextualize all of this in other theories of, for example, vulnerability and relational lens as well. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what the vulnerability literature would like add to all of this.
Yeah, so I've done, in the past, I've done quite a lot of work with vulnerability theory and thinking about it in relation to disability and mental capacity. And I think it's a really useful starting point actually for getting us to think particularly about this idea of on an equal basis with others, because I think with vulnerability theory it's very much focused on the universal vulnerability, so not kind of hiving off different categories of individual that should have, you know, a particular legal framework applied to them as a necessary starting point. It's about normalizing and seeing interdependence and care, for example, as part of everyone's lives and turning that idea of this rational, individualistic legal subject on its head. So I think that in itself gives a really interesting starting point, and I can certainly see some parallels with the, you know, with the social model of disability, but also with the CRPD, because the CRPD is obviously very much rooted in the social model quite explicitly. So it then, with vulnerability theory, obviously we need to think about vulnerability as universal, but also as particular. So the experience of that vulnerability is experienced in particular ways given someone's social context. So it gets us to, you know, it's not about saying everyone's vulnerable, so treat them the same. It's about being really attentive then to the particular kind of social, environmental, political context that that person is residing in. So I think, you know, that is, it does give some really important insights to the CRPD, but also Article 12, in that it's not necessarily saying, and this, my reading of the Article 12 has always been that it's not necessarily saying you need to then, you know, if we're treating legal capacities on an equal basis with others, that's not necessarily saying we then need to kind of step back and not intervene in anyone's decision making. And I think, you know, the vulnerability theory can be really helpful in thinking that through, because there is a danger that you then, you know, you can reinforce the individualistic reading of mental capacity law and the kind of liberal legal subject through that. And I think that is exactly what is to be avoided. And I don't think that a kind of true, if there is such a thing, but a kind of careful reading of the CRP doesn't necessitate that at all. I think in that sense, vulnerability theory has got a lot of tools there. And I think the other part of vulnerability theory, it's not just about, you know, defining vulnerability. And I think Martha Fineman's kind of quite clear that, you know, that's not the point to get caught up on. The point is about the responsive state and institutions. And I think, you know, again, there's tools there to think about how the state might be configured differently if it was built on the idea of the vulnerable legal subject rather than the liberal legal subject. How might institutions be configured? And in this context, how might law and, you know, the kind of legal frameworks like mental capacity law be configured differently if we weren't starting from the idea of incapacitous individuals with cognitive impairments being in this kind of separate legal realm, and kind of shoring up the idea of the capacitous autonomous subject? How might these be differently configured? So I think vulnerability theory's got quite a lot of interesting tools there for us to think about this. I guess where I not necessarily depart, but I think there's room to think it through more carefully here, is to think not, and I think this is where the kind of the spatial literature is really interesting and useful, is in really carefully seeing how why we have got to the current configuration of the state and institutions through that legal framework and how they're all working together. So it's kind of that historical kind of temporal understanding of how they're very closely intertwined, so that thinking very carefully about responses and coming back to that idea that it's often it's not necessarily as straightforward as just, you know, a kind of tweak here and there to the terminology in the Mental Capacity Act, or, you know, it's much more of a kind of wholesale, holistic rethinking about that, those institutional kind of structural relations and how they can be configured differently.
Yeah, and I think in her scholarship, Camilla Kong picks up on this critique of the idea of Article 12 being interpreted in this non-interventionist sort of way, and thinking about whether or not that actually does protect autonomy, and if this sort of concept of autonomy is actually something that is worthy of protection and to sort of draw out that it's not actually neutral. This relates, I think, to the next part of the book, perhaps overlaps, you could say. So the next sort of binary is that of care and disability. You position those. That's a really interesting sort of contrast, because it's not, you know, I guess it's not how the sort of legal framework necessarily is assumed to position care and disability in binaries. So why do you position care and disability as binaries?
Yeah, so I think with this, it's really stemming from the work in disability studies. Just to kind of take a step back, with my own work, I started thinking about the role of carers and where carers were in mental capacity law, and how really kind of critiquing the mental capacity act through a care ethics lens. In thinking about the best interest assessment, for example, it's very much focused on the individual lacking capacity, at least on the face of the Mental Capacity Act. So it's not about someone else's best interests. It's just about that individual's best interests. And carers and kind of informal carers and family are there just as kind of ways to understand a little bit more about that individual's best interests. It's not about the relationship as a whole, or what legal response might best facilitate that kind of care relationship. And then in my kind of next project, when I was thinking about the social model of disability, there was a real challenge in the disability studies literature to ideas of care. And I really hit up against this kind of barrier that care ethics and disability studies had quite an uneasy history. And I think some of this, from looking into a lot of the writing in that area, particularly in the kind of 80s and 90s, it stemmed from a lot of the kind of feminist care ethics work around the way that deinstitutionalization kind of, it was framed as kind of creating a burden on informal carers and family carers, and tying this to these kind of broader critiques of how responsibility was privatized into these kind of domestic spaces rather than the state kind of recognizing their responsibility. So it was this kind of physical moving of disabled people from institutions into the community, which actually translated often as into domestic spaces. It privatized responsibility, privatized dependency, and the kind of feminist care ethics literature around that time was very critical of this. But at the same time, there was the big disability studies critique that independent living movement was a big part of that drive to deinstitutionalization. And so there was this real clash, and also in the disability study movement, there was a real concern about care. Disabled people didn't want to be seen as objects of care. They wanted to be subjects in their own right. Care was seen as a kind of demeaning practice, and it wasn't about care for disabled people. It was about their independence. It's kind of been positioned as this clash between care and disability. I think it's something that the CRPD needs to tread carefully with as well, because I think there is a slight risk with the CRPD that the role of carers and the role of others in disabled people's lives is almost minimized. And I think there's a concern in the kind of care ethics literature about what this might translate to, and whether carers become just seen as these conduits for disabled people to provide their agency, whereas carers' agency can be further undermined. And I think for me, I think what I've found is that the kernels within both of these theories are very much the same. So care theory and disability studies are very much about interdependence, relationality. The kind of independent living movement in disability studies was never about people just saying they want to be left alone. It was never about this kind of individualistic liberal subject. It was about the kind of provision of resources to facilitate people's independence. It's a very different emphasis there. And I think both care theory and disability studies are very much focused on the provision of resources and support. So I think there's been a kind of tendency, there's almost been a caricature, I think, around care and disability studies that has prevented this useful alliance that there could be in terms of, for me, a broader challenging of, again, coming back to responsibility and accountability and the role of the state. So I think, what I've been trying to do in that chapter is to draw attention to that kind of, and recognise those, the kind of previous theoretical antagonisms that there've been, but to really to draw out the alliances that can be drawn there, and the resources from both of the approaches that aren't necessarily antithetical, but that both actually really push towards this recognition of our embeddedness within these kind of networks and resource networks, and really pushing against any moves to privatise dependence and responsibility, either within disabled people or within kind of care spaces.
There's honestly so much more I could ask you, but I do see we're running out of time. Just before you go, I'm wondering if you can tell me, do you have any key takeaways? And also our famous last question for the New Books Network, what are you working on now?
Yeah, so I guess there's... I think two things that I hope come from the book. One is really about being very careful when we're thinking about legal reform in this area, and just to kind of think through how proposals for reform will kind of link to these binaries. And, you know, as I've mentioned earlier, I think there's often a risk that if we kind of just chip away and solely focus on one, then that means that the other binaries tend to get shored up in a way to kind of maintain that legal framework and that kind of internal coherence that is built around that legal framework. So I think it's really about being very careful and being attentive to these wider, the context of mental capacity law. And I think one of the things that I mentioned in the conclusion actually is that it may be that new binaries pop up. Can we have a legal framework that isn't, is there something kind of as part of law that means that it has to work in these kind of binary ways? I think Margaret Davies' work is really good for getting us to think about law and, you know, Law Unlimited. And but I think at least even if we do have these new binaries pop up, we can understand them and we are being attentive to them as part of these legal reform processes, rather than just seeing them as necessarily kind of a fixed part of the legal landscape. I think I also hope that people take a hopeful message from the book. I think that, you know, there is quite a lot of kind of critical commentary on the Mental Capacity Act. But I think one of the things that I'm really hoping to signal, particularly through thinking in terms of legal geography and these processes, is that these frameworks and these logics are inherently unstable, and that they can be changed. But, if we can begin to map these binaries and how they work together and how, you know, the different kind of institutional and structural relations that these sustain, then I think it gives us actually some more kind of critical tools for thinking about different sites for legal change and different sites for kind of progressive reform attention that aren't simply just hinged to things like autonomy. And I think it actually opens up, hopefully, some new perspectives on where we can start to challenge. And it might even be very small shifts that actually have some of the bigger kind of consequences here. And so what am I working on now? I think a couple of things that stem most immediately from the book. One is thinking about temporality, and there is a huge and growing body of particularly social legal literature on temporality in law, and I think the mental capacity context provides a really interesting case study for this. Some of the points in the book, I talk about this kind of linear progressive temporality that we see in some of the mental capacity cases. The WMA case that I talk about in the care and disability chapter, and this idea of this kind of progressive move through to adulthood, and this increasing autonomy and independence that ought to come with that, and how that is kind of pressed down onto kind of non-conforming relationships between parents and their disabled children. But I also think the temporality at a broader kind of, in terms of the whole way that the legal framework works, and actually how that jars with the very different temporality that I think we have in the CRPD. And I wonder whether this is part of why, when scholars and policymakers and practitioners are trying to think through ways that we can make mental capacity law compatible with the CRPD, I think the very different temporality of how interventions are seen and the role of the state is seen in these two different frameworks is part of why there seems to be such a clash. And then the second thing that I've been kind of thinking about for a couple of years now is home, and how that really comes through in the work around liberty and disability in a home, and the way that home and domestic spaces are seen as these sites where dependency and care is privatized and this responsibility is kind of shifted. So I'm doing some work thinking about law and home through a kind of spatial legal geography lens, at a kind of broader level, and then kind of funneling that down into thinking about the implications for mental capacity law and disability and concepts like liberty as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you've given some really sort of inspiring paths for research there, and I can't wait to read more of what you do.
Thank you.
it's always so good to end on a hopeful note, because you know a lot of this work isn't always so hopeful. So thank you so much.
That's
brilliant. Just to finish off today, firstly, thank you so much, Dr. Beverly Clough, for being on the show. It's really great. I'm Jane Richards, and I've been speaking with Dr. Beverly Clough about her book, The Spaces of Mental Capacity Law, Moving Beyond Binaries. It was published by Routledge in 2022. This is New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. Bev, thanks for your time.
Thanks.